Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's cool fact of the day is that you can burn up to 7% more calories by walking on hard dirt, like a trail, compared to walking on pavement. This has to do with the micro corrections that you do in your gait in order to correct for an uneven surface. Of course, if you're actually looking to exercise to burn calories, you haven't been reading the blog or listening to the podcast for very long, because it turns out exercise is only responsible for about 50, maybe 60% of the calories you burn, and you don't burn that many calories exercising when you look at a caloric burn table. So I recommend you don't worry about how many calories you burn when you move. You just make sure that you move so you can get lymphatic drainage, and you work really hard on making sure that when you do exercise, you're getting the hormonal benefits of exercise.
All right.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Dave Asprey with the Bulletproof Executive, and I'm here in New York City in a hotel room with Greg Pomerantz, who is a citizen scientist slash personal experimenter who's done some really fascinating research on salt that was recently published. Greg, tell us, what did you do?
So I got interested in this salt idea, thinking about blood pressure, seeing if there's a way. My blood pressure is normal, but it's a little higher than I might like it to be. So was trying to think about what are the things that people say affect blood pressure, and salt is the first thing that most people think of.
Yeah.
So, I did a lot of research on what people say about salt. The health authorities come out, and now again last week, the American Heart Association says that 1,500 milligrams is the upper limit for all adult humans. So that's, the numbers keep coming down. I think I haven't read that paper yet, so I'm not sure, whether there's anything new or if it's just, a stronger interpretation of the science that a lot of us have read already. But what we do know about salt is that there's really two types of people. There are people that are considered salt sensitive, and those people, when they eat salt, their body holds onto it maybe a little bit too much, and blood pressure goes up right away in those people. And then there are other people who are called salt resistant, and their body can adjust very quickly to changes in salt intake. So their blood pressure is not affected in the short term by salt. So I thought it's pretty easy to figure out which category you fall into, and it seems like useful information that you can get basically for free. So
how did you set up your experiment to determine how sensitive you were to salt?
So the experiment I'll set up is pretty standard, what you would use in a research setting to diagnose salt sensitivity. And I suppose your doctor could use this approach too if they were a little crazy and had a couple weeks to play around with it. So all you really need is a blood pressure cuff. Measure your blood pressure every morning, and there's ways to do that reliably where you sit quietly for 3 minutes and then do three measurements and average them. And then you have three phases. So you establish a baseline, and then for 2 weeks you restrict salt from the diet to see what does your blood pressure do when there's no salt coming in other than what's in your food. In my case, that's about 800 to 1,000 milligrams of sodium in the diet. And that's about what you would see in the research protocols. And then there's a salt loading phase after that, and that's the fun part because you get to eat massive amounts of salt, usually beyond what you would consume in your normal diet.
Like how many grams a day are we talking?
So I had a gram of sodium in my baseline diet, and then an additional 5 grams from salt. So that was sea salt, so it has, you know, other minerals. And sea salt usually has a little bit of water in it too, so it's more grams per milligram of sodium and dirt and whatever else is in sea salt. So
seagull poop.
It was 15 grams of sea salt during the loading phase. That was 2 weeks. So I think it's it was a little bit of a challenge to eat that that much salt. I don't know if you've tried to salt load to that.
So inquiring minds want to know, did it give you the runs?
Only the first night.
Yeah, okay, not too surprising. And you did it at night.
Well, the first night, I decided that I wanted to see what happens in the short term.
Okay.
So I did the 15 grams of salt after the 3 weeks of salt restriction with my dinner over 2 hours. And that gave me a little bit of the rush. I also gained 6 pounds in two hours, which is
You swelled up a little bit?
Interesting, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So,
but I was coming off of dehydration from the salt restriction.
Okay, so you were rehydrating as part of it. So what did you learn in your experiment? Like, what were your final results?
So the results were as expected from my background, you know, my genetic background. I'm not salt sensitive, so my blood pressure really didn't change very much. Between the baseline and the salt-restricted phase, there was no difference.
Okay.
And then in the salt-loading phase, there was possibly a little increase in the diastolic blood pressure. That's the low number. The high number didn't change at all, which I guess normally they would move together, and normally they would move by 5 to 10 points in a salt-sensitive person. So clearly not salt-sensitive. But there were a couple of odd outcomes in the salt-restricted phase.
What did you learn there?
Yeah, I was clearly dehydrated, and I think there was, you know, biologically or through osmosis, you know, if there's salt and a membrane, for example, the water will flow to where it's salty to try to equalize the salt content. So if you restrict salt in your diet, you'll probably lose water unless your kidneys are extremely good at holding on to salt. And there are some people that are like that, and maybe most people, I don't know. Certainly it's part of what makes humans different from other animals is that we're the way we handle salt in our kidneys and but for me, I wasn't able to keep the sodium in my body, apparently, and therefore I lost water. I got dehydrated. So when I went outside on a hot day, for example, I would my body temperature went up, and I think what's going on is that my heart, the cardiovascular system, helps cool the body, and if there's the blood volume's too low, it can't do that effectively.
Wow!
So my body got hot. My heart raced, my pulse increased, and my temperature went up. But I know it wasn't a fever because I would go inside and it would come back down. So it wasn't the body actively trying to increase my temperature.
What was your cognitive experience when you were on a low-salt diet? Could you feel a difference in how you thought or how you felt your energy levels?
Well, certainly from an exercise perspective, I was less strong, mm-hmm. and I was less able to exercise. I wouldn't say that I noticed any cognitive changes in the 2 weeks.
It didn't drop your blood pressure enough for you to
have
less brain energy. Yeah, that's true. It didn't drop it at all. Okay.
I don't know whether if it was a few more weeks, if something would have happened. It was interesting that it didn't drop my blood pressure because it dehydrated me. And possibly in a few more weeks, it would have gotten more severe. And
probably your cortisol must have gone up to raise your blood pressure in response to lower blood volume.
Yeah, I know there's some...
Probably stressed your body.
I didn't have sleep issues.
You didn't? Okay, that would be a sign of cortisol.
Yeah,
and it's weird.
A good question.
It's weird, too, that you took the sodium at night and didn't have a particular effect from that because...
I had a headache.
Oh, you did get a headache, okay.
I did, but I was able to get back to sleep.
You were okay.
So I think my body is good at dealing with extra salt.
It sounds like it.
And certainly... You know, I didn't have negative effects during the salt loading phase. And in fact, after the second day, I didn't even think that my food was especially salty. It was just...
felt normal.
I got used to it by the second or third day.
I do between 6 and 10 grams of salt a day, and I have for almost 10 years now, just based on reading the research and looking at how it affects my cognitive and my physical performance. I'm stronger when I have more salt, which is maybe why we used to pay our soldiers in salt. Who knows? But at night, what happens is the body works to raise the potassium levels and magnesium levels, really, and sodium is less important. And it's that wake-up cycle in the morning when you basically need the sodium. So your adrenals have to pump out some cortisol to raise your blood pressure and to work on that sodium-potassium balance, which is why I'd say take your salt in the morning, not only in the morning, but you know, have a dose in the morning, even in water, like a half a teaspoon to a teaspoon. And then at night is when you should take your potassium and your magnesium just to help your body in the changes it's already doing so you get less sort of wasteful systemic stress. Right.
And actually the adrenals in the morning will be actually telling your kidneys to hold on to salt. And that's one of their functions.
Yeah, they're trying to raise it. So if you basically add some extra to it, they're like, oh, this is easy to hold on to salt. It's just coming right on in.
There's a really tragic story in the salt appetite literature.
Oh, yeah.
There's a paper by... Geerling, I think is his name. I can send you the citation for that.
I'd love that.
And he's writing about the central regulation of salt appetite. Mm-hmm. And what happened to me in the salt restricted phase, although I had this temperature control problem, I never had cravings for salt.
Wow.
And I think it's, for a long time, scientists would try, they knew if you restrict salt from an animal, they'll crave salt, and they'll go and find salt. But if you do that to a human, they don't do that, unless the salt gets so, you know, catastrophically low that they're about to die.
Yeah, they'll start to crave it at a certain point.
So there's a story where there's a little child who had been born with a problem in his adrenal glands, and if the adrenals aren't working, they can't tell the kidneys to maintain sodium. So the kid was constantly... excreting sodium. The child's first word was salt. Oh. And his parents were very attentive, and they knew that he wanted salt, and they would give it to him. And in fact, he would crawl out of his crib at night and go find salt because he knew where it was. And it's tragic because he was put in the hospital and
they restricted his salt.
And he died.
Oh.
This is in the 40s or 50s this happened. So there is sodium appetite in humans, but I think it's for some reason, and it could be because humans have always had enough salt, that we don't have that adaptation where we have to crave it like we crave other things.
Well, even before we had, it's sort of paleo-ish thinking, you know, before we established the spice routes for trading, we had the salt routes, which became the establishment. So... in areas where there was no salt, like mountainous regions, there was definitely an appetite. Like, they knew they needed it.
Right.
And I think maybe we just kind of forgot it. Like, there's so much awareness that's in the human body.
Yeah.
I have developed my salt, whatever you want to call it, my salt taste. Yeah. I can tell whether I'm low on salt or high on salt. And one of the things that happens to me, I noticed in particular in Nepal, I was at high altitude and trying to sort of super hydrate. And I said, I'll just drink like a liter and a half of water. So I just chugged it. Mm-hmm. And I was out of salt. I'd take salt with me, especially for mountaineering things, because I just do better when I put salt in my water. And about 10 minutes later, I started getting sort of like dizzy and just psychologically, I could tell like my brain was scrambled. And I think feeling the extreme of that made me more aware that salt is a component to how my brain works and like how my body feels in some like intrinsic sense. It's hard to say.
Yeah, certainly if you're salt depleted, drinking a lot of water is the last thing you want to do.
Yeah, that was a bad
even though you're dehydrated because of the salt depletion, the water is now going to make your sodium levels even lower by dilution.
And that's what happened. In fact, fortunately, being a biohacker, I knew this. So the next little tea house I came to on the trail there, 10 miles from the nearest road, I just sort of like looked at the guy and gave him a rupee and opened up his salt shaker and poured it in my hand and just was like licking my hand, right? And I felt better within 5 minutes. It was amazing.
So it sounds like you may have similar genetics or biology that I have. That we need, and we don't necessarily crave it, but we can tell, I guess. And I think I'll be more attentive to this as well.
It's a definite lesson to feel the edges of what your body can do, right?
Yeah.
I know I'd be miserable, and I would not really function very well on a salt-restricted diet. I go to Whole Foods, they have those little real salt packets, and there are a gram of salt in each one. And whether it's a gram of sodium, I don't know. I haven't looked. It's totally dry anyway. It's the Redmond sea salt.
Okay.
But I'll put 5 grams of that stuff on my dinner, no problem at all. And I'm completely happy with it. And when I restrict it, it's like my body's going, like, you need your butter, you need your salt. What about renin? Did you do any... any research on renin?
Well, what I did do before I wrote up the salt results was I looked into what is it actually that regulates blood pressure, right? And there's
you mean coffee?
So there's this guy Arthur Guyton, and what he did in 1966, picture this: he used a computer to model blood pressure control.
Wow!
And he took everything that was known, which is includes renin, but it also includes thirst. It includes, arterial stiffness, includes cardiac function, volume. It includes blood viscosity. So all the fluid dynamics and everything he could think of, and he wrote all these equations and put them in the computer on, punch cards.
Wow.
I'm assuming.
It must have been.
And what he figured out was when he ran some experiments, he said, what happens to the patient if we amputate, cut the leg off, and increase the resistance in the blood vessels? And what he figured out was that the kidney says, oh, the blood pressure is too high, let's get rid of some salt, or let's get rid of some water and, balance the electrolytes. And over a couple of days, the kidney will get the blood pressure back to where it's supposed to be. And renin is a part of that, and angiotensin and aldosterone and all these other hormones, antidiuretic hormone, and there's... But at the end of the day, there's this computational network, right, in the body that lets the kidney set the blood pressure. So, after seeing this and reading about it, I think I guess I'm less interested in the particular biochemistry of any given hormone, because I think they work together, and you can get hyper-focused on one thing, but it's not telling you the whole story.
Blood pressure is one of those things like cholesterol. It's so easy to measure. So we spend a lot of time thinking about it and correlating it, but just because it's easy to measure doesn't mean it's a good, a good indicator of the status of something. What did you do with respect to magnesium and potassium and calcium, the other minerals that really are a part of this whole axis?
So I left them pretty much where they were. So my potassium was around 4 grams a day. Magnesium probably 500-600 milligrams. This is all from food. It was vegetables and
spinach. That's a pretty high dose to get from food.
So I try to eat like half a pound of spinach every day.
Okay.
Because I need extra folate for some genetic reason.
So you're a poor methylator.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, I am too.
So I go for the folate. I just boil a pound of spinach and eat half of it and save half for the next day.
Why don't you eat it raw?
Because of the cell walls.
The cell walls, okay. It's not the oxalic acid. I was wondering, because we're talking about kidneys, and raw spinach has a lot of oxalic acid in it that affects kidney function negatively. Right. So that's a mistake a lot of vegans make. It's like you're just cramming the raw spinach down. Right. Like, cook your spinach, for God's sake.
I cook it for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I think when people hear that, oh, cooking destroys nutrients, they're misreading the research, because what it says is if you boil the spinach and throw away the water, then you lose 90% of the folate. If you don't throw away the water, then you lose 3% of the folate, or 5%. So
And some enzymes might go away, but we do have a pancreas for a reason to make enzymes, and you can take them endogenously or exogenously if you need to.
Yeah, I would. It would take a long time to eat half a pound of spinach.
Yeah,
but if you boil it and make soup, you can just
you can fit quite a lot of spinach down. Okay, so you're tracking your magnesium and your potassium. And some of the people that I've worked with at the Silicon Valley Health Institute, where it's an anti-aging nonprofit, where we have people come in and give a lecture every month about the latest anti-aging things, several of the people there have said, look, it's not about the total sodium, it's about the ratio of sodium to potassium and magnesium. And a lot of the blood pressure issues people have are actually magnesium deficiencies.
Right.
Which is why on the top 10 list of biohacking supplements, it's like, take your vitamin D, take your magnesium. If you do those things right, you're going to be hitting a lot of things with just two stones, kind of.
Yeah, I think I've taken magnesium before, never saw any difference. So I think that...
In your blood pressure, do you track it?
I've looked at blood pressure versus magnesium, not systematically, but...
Okay. It doesn't have to be fully systematic like that, right?
Yeah. It didn't seem to help my sleep. It didn't. So I've always assumed that my magnesium was pretty solid.
Okay.
It's an interesting thing to try. I think the potassium-sodium ratios, I've heard that in the context of Paleolithic diet reconstructions. And I don't know how reliable those are. I think, on the one hand, Lauren Cordain's reconstruction, he says they were eating 750 milligrams of sodium a day. And I don't, genetically or physiologically, I can't do that. So
I have a hard time believing that too.
Yeah,
I might say a highly stressed population that didn't have a choice might have done that. But when they had a choice, they always put sodium in.
I mean, certainly we know since civilization, since agriculture, every civilization has valued salt, like you were
very highly
before. And it's... all kinds of empires were built on salt.
Have you heard of the aquatic ape theory and how that may affect sodium retention?
I've heard of the theory.
I don't know that I believe it or not, but it was an interesting idea in that they're saying, well, we're one of the few mammals that has this thin skin that doesn't heal very well when you cut it compared to the way, if you cut a cow or a horse or something, the wound looks very different because they don't have that subcutaneous layer of fat. And that the subcutaneous layer of fat is more like a water-dwelling mammal, and just like our hair is as well. So that this theory, whether it's not true, who the heck knows?
But I remember at some point looking into it and deciding that I didn't believe it.
Yeah, I'm skeptical.
I can't remember why.
But if you go back long enough in the evolutionary chain, like it's pretty clear lots of things lived in the water at some point, but it may have been back at the amoeba stage. But the reason that this came to mind for me right now is that we're talking about, how much do we hold on to sodium? And the bottom line is, we tend to hold on to it carefully to conserve it. But if we evolved to be swimming or evolved at some point in our evolution to be in the ocean and all, we would have basically treated sodium very differently than we do now.
Right.
So it's an interesting theory that may have something to do with just why we're so different with salt and why we don't treat salt like other animals do.
Yeah, I mean, there is an interesting study that I talked about on my blog. That
what's your URL, by the way? We're going to put it as a link on the site and in the transcript, but tell us now.
Yeah, so my blog is nelismegafauna.blogspot.com.
Okay.
And it is at some point I'll come up with a real name for it. That's where it is right now. So there's this idea that I call it the Faustian kidney bargain. And what it is, scientist named Watanabe, Japanese researcher, and his idea, and he's been arguing this for a long time. He might be kind of like the aquatic ape where there's one person who is pushing this idea. It doesn't make it wrong, right? It could be right. The idea is that in the Miocene, which mm-hmm. is 24 million to 8 million years ago. So we're not hominids really yet. We're the ancestors of chimpanzees, gorillas, and humans.
Okay.
They were tree dwelling, and they ate fruit and leaves. So some people today eat fruit and leaves. Some humans follow that kind of diet. But these were pretty much obligate frugivores and mm-hmm. folivores, which I guess you'd call someone who eats leaves. And there's no salt in fruits or leaves. So
yeah.
The idea is that they can trace certain genetic mutations back to this time.
Wow.
That involve the particular one in this paper is an enzyme called urate oxidase. And it takes uric acid mm-hmm. and it breaks it down.
That's pretty important if you're eating a lot of fruit. Because fructose raises uric acid, right?
It's the opposite of what you would think.
Oh, right? Really?
Because the genetic mutations break urate oxidase. So for these tree-dwelling proto-apes, the genetic mutation raised their uric acid levels. And what happens when your uric acid is high, there are multiple different pathways that it can raise your blood pressure.
Ah.
In the short term or in the long term.
Maybe because they were salt deficient.
Exactly.
Wow. Because one of the things, if you want to evolve a big brain, you've got to get enough blood into the brain. You need to have the efficient pumping right. system. And certainly controlling blood pressure is a major factor for cooling the brain and for keeping it oxygenated. Huh. Right. This is fascinating. I hadn't come across that research before.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is in the short term, it via renin and angiotensin, creates inflammation and the blood pressure just goes up. It creates vasoconstriction and tells the kidney to hold on to salt. In the long term, it damages the kidney and makes you salt sensitive mm-hmm. over time. So, and this gene has not just happened to break. It's actually been broken multiple different ways. It's been completely trashed.
Wow.
So it's an interesting idea. And I think the prevailing view is that uric acid is an antioxidant. That's what people think. For some reason, we evolved higher uric acid than every other mammal. But
I've seen some protective effects, but if it gets too high, you're not a happy camper,
exactly.
right? Wow. Okay.
So it could be, I call it a Faustian kidney,
yeah.
because you're basically evolved to destroy your own kidneys. And there are trade-offs because you can now survive without salt, but you're damaging your kidneys, your heart, you're getting gout, all these potential other problems are coming.
So this may be where renin comes into play.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know for sure the biochemical pathways relating to renin and uric acid, but when you talk about those types of damage, mm-hmm. what we do know from Michael Alderman, who's done his work as the head of the American Society of Hypertension, mm-hmm. he did a study of 3,000 people where he looked at what sodium did they eat and what mm-hmm. sodium did they excrete in their urine, and pretty good mm-hmm. sample size. And he came out with a quote that says, if you want to live longer, eat more salt. Mm-hmm. And the main reason that that mattered was because of renin, where you cut salt, and I think it was a 25% reduction in salt raised mm-hmm. renin by something like 2%. But a 2% mm-hmm. rise in renin dramatically increases your risk of having a heart mm-hmm. attack, which is why you get people with low blood pressure, who are running marathons and have heart attacks. It's a very complex system. And like you said, all the hormones work together. You change one, this other one changes, and then that changes this.
Right. Well, there's another little bit of research I came across having to do with renin. This guy, Froelich, mm-hmm. I think is his name. And he's of the opinion that sodium may not increase your blood pressure today, but it could in 10 years if you load it over the long term. And
right, we'll soon see for me.
there's a lot of rat research yeah. that's underlying this opinion.
Okay.
So we have to understand, obviously, we're not rats. And we know, as we just talked about, humans are a lot different from other mammals in this respect. But there's cell studies and there's some very interesting evidence having to do with people who are on diuretic drugs
mm-hmm.
and beta blockers and things like
yeah.
that, which manipulate these hormone systems. And so what he says is that renin works systemically. The kidney releases renin and triggers the other hormones from the adrenals. But renin also acts locally. So, and you won't know that unless you're doing a kidney biopsy.
Ah.
So there are cases where salt is high and there's something to do with renin that's doing something in the kidney locally. So I think there's, again, a lot of complexity that you never, a hormone never does one thing in the body, or a molecule never does just one thing.
So it sounds like it's time to ask a kidney surgeon. If there's one listening, post a comment here. That would be awesome, actually.
If we can get some maybe preserved or living kidneys in vats that we can do, you know, repeated biopsies on them.
That sounds like great fun. Of course, if we can do that, then we could probably also have vat-grown meat. And that just sounds terrible. So what's up? What's up next? What other experiments are you going to do?
Well, actually, this week, so I've been eating a lot of butter this year. And in the beginning of the year, I thought, let's see what happens if I eat a bunch of butter. And I loved it. It was great. It initially lowered my cholesterol, which is pretty weird.
Were you focusing on grass-fed butter?
The way I was. Okay. I was eating Kerrygold butter. I tried a local brand, which had the opposite effect. It lowered my HDL and did some bad things.
Was it local grass-fed?
It was. Well, local grass-fed, I don't know.
Maybe not that 100%. Wow, that's quite interesting.
It wasn't a farmer that I know well.
Okay.
So over the long term, a couple, maybe a month or two longer term, it looked like, you know, my HDL was still up, but the other stuff was back to where it was. And I also did a little bit of testing on my meter, which is a cardio check, a cholesterol meter, and it really doesn't measure total cholesterol very accurately. It's off, and it has a very wide variance between. You can measure yourself three times in 10 minutes, and you'll get a lot different numbers. So
that's why I haven't bought one of them. I really want a home cholesterol meter that's accurate.
But. Well, there's, I have to wonder whether the lab tests are much better. And I don't know the answer to that.
I think I do. They're better, but not that much better. Mm-hmm. One of the anti-aging physicians that I really respect, Dr. Miller, who runs antiaging.com, he's been doing this sort of thing for 30 years, you know, quantitative blood work to look at these things. And he literally, you go to his office and he gives you his lab requisition form, and he works specifically with the lab. And he's the guy who calls the lab and says, you've got a problem because all my patients are trending up. So quality control, now that the labs are consolidated, especially the big ones, quality control is a major issue there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I don't know what the standard published margin of error is, but the actual fact that you get this done at this lab and you get the same test run at this lab, your results could be pretty different.
Right. So what I did find out was the HDL measurements are very good in the meter.
Okay.
They're 2%.
Oh, wow.
And they matched the lab results within 1 point, you know, and that, so that was a good thing. And some of the experiments I did last year, for example, I tried eating safe starches for a month and had 100 grams of carbs through sweet potatoes every day.
How did that affect you?
My HDL went down 20%. And everything else, my exercise recovery was terrible. And something I haven't talked about or written about yet, which I have been preparing to publish, is my triglycerides after meals went up because of the carbs. And I think there's some ways to kind of make sense of that.
I mean, it makes great sense. Carbs do tend to raise triglycerides, particularly fructose-based carbs. But it's
interesting. I mean, they're known to raise fasting triglycerides.
Oh, but not postprandial.
Well, I think they are. And there's, I think it's actually a low carbohydrate diet that lowers postprandial triglycerides. But I think that there's some in between places where you're still eating a lot of fat, but you're eating too much carbohydrate for your body, where you can get into trouble after meals.
I share your thinking there. I've looked at the Ketogenic diet, you know, where they're eating stupid amounts of starch, like McDougal levels of starch, if I can go so far. Well, no, not very low fat. Okay. They're eating 70% carbs, but the rest of their diet is almost all saturated fat. And it's not extremely low, it's 70%
like
carbs.
Coconut. MCT.
It's almost all coconut, right?
Yeah. So it works.
So part of me sort of says, well, okay, maybe even a butter and coconut oil, you know, soak your rice and your potato in that, and maybe you can get by on it. And you can. Like, you'll feel okay on that diet. Eventually, you're going to need protein. But I don't think it's optimal, and it's going to have the triglyceride effect you're having. But if you ditch the fat and you go for, like, an almost all-starch diet, like they're recommending in these books with, you know, a teaspoon of safflower oil, I don't understand how that's a sustainable diet for human beings. I really
at some point, I'm going to try that, but Not this year.
I'd love to see your numbers before and after.
Yeah, me too.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are? I mean, you don't have to answer if you don't want.
37.
37, okay, yeah. Cool. Because that has an effect too, right? You know, there's something that happens between 30 and 40 that you know, I'm 40, so we're about 30. The same age. Uh-huh. But, like, your body's different now than it was when you were 27. Like, you've sort of hit that peak where there's a decade of stability, but some of the hormones start to decline and things like that.
That may be so. I feel a lot better than I did when I was 27.
Yeah, I do too. I'm in every way more powerful and healthier than I was even when I was 20. So it's amazing what paying attention to your data and just to how you're doing can make you feel.
Yeah, so the triglyceride question, since you brought up the ketones, right? So they eat starches and coconut fat. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what fats do to your triglycerides, if you just do a fat challenge, you give someone 75 grams of fat of different kinds and see where their triglycerides go. The low-carb people will tell you that fat doesn't raise your triglycerides, mm-hmm. which is not true.
No, it's not true.
And you can look at countless papers that show a curve, just like a blood sugar curve, mm-hmm. And it peaks between 3 and 6 hours. Mm-hmm. The earlier the peak, the healthier, typically. I think those long peaks are probably some kind of inflammatory reaction to the diet. But if you look at what different fats do, you see that from worst to best, the omega-6 is the worst.
Yeah.
And
that's why I've basically taken it out of the Bulletproof diet anywhere I can. I'm like, just don't eat that stuff.
The monounsaturateds are the second worst.
Yep.
Saturateds are pretty good. The MCTs are excellent, and they may not raise your triglycerides at all. And the omega-3s improve your triglycerides. Mm-hmm. So you can eat a very high omega-3 diet. There's one experiment. I love it because it shows a very large effect. Mm-hmm. In most science published papers, you see these tiny little effects, and they need these statistics. You don't need statistics for this because they gave some group of people 25% of their calories or some huge number from fish oil. Mm-hmm. And then they gave them a fat test with a regular standardized fat challenge. And their triglycerides were super low after that.
I believe it.
Because the baseline diet. So it's the type of fat, it's the baseline diet. A low-carb diet lowers postprandial triglycerides. There's a paper by Volek and Finney on that. Interesting stuff. So I never told you what my next experiment that I'm doing now.
Yeah.
So my HDL has always been high, but my non-HDL pretty much over the past 10 years has been a little high, and it's mm-hmm. been slowly creeping up, and you can see there's a trend line in one of my experiments showing it. So I thought, last summer, I'm going to try to eat less red meat. I'm going to eat a lot of chicken instead.
Okay.
So I checked my number last week, and it was even higher. It's the highest I've ever seen it.
That would be because of the omega-6 in the chicken.
Well, that's one explanation. Yeah. The other explanation is I eat 4 eggs a day and a stick of butter. So that didn't have an effect right away.
Maybe it's
a long-term effect. So my idea for this week, it's a very short thing. I'm going to see. If you think about the body regulating cholesterol, it's mm-hmm. going to sense how much is coming in and then dispose of the stuff it doesn't need or regulate the production.
That's what the liver's for, right?
So if you suddenly go from a high cholesterol diet to a low cholesterol diet, what happens? So I want to see in the short term if the number comes down.
And you're going to use your CardioCheck meter daily. That is a fascinating experiment. I can't wait to see that.
I'm not using it daily. I'm using it maybe twice this week.
Okay.
And then I go on vacation, and my cholesterol always goes down on vacation. So
that's unusual.
I think it's sleep stress.
Okay. Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah. Wow. This has been a really cool, just fascinating conversation. I appreciate you taking time kind of late at night to come to the hotel right after I landed here in New York so I could interview you. Tell us your blog one more time so people can read up on these cool experiments you did.
Sure. So the blog is at neelesmegafauna.blogspot.com.
You want to spell that for us?
Yeah, KNEELESSMEGAFAUNA.blogspot.com.
Thank you so very much for your time, and I will chat with you online.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
Greg. Thank you, Dave.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.